But first to Canberra to talk with Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent with SBS. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Now, Susan Lee is on the road selling net zero. How do you think she's going?
Well, she's certainly showing that she has a lot of gumption to get out there and make the case. Today, she did the kind of media that would sort of make many politicians kind of curl up in the fetal position. It was just very intense. She did multiple podcasts. She did a press conference. She did 7:30 tonight. So she is throwing everything at trying to sell this policy, sell herself as the credible leader of the opposition, and message to her own party that she has a lot of energy and that they should be backing her to continue on in that job.
And she talked to you. How did you find her? What is it like to interview Susan Lee?
Look, she's generous with her time, and she's certainly, I think, in terms of the different types of personalities you come across, she holds her ground and she can be combative, but she's also, I think, keen to engage. I do find her to be the type of interviewee that listens and does genuinely attempt to answer the question in some cases. But, you know, she's very clear about when she doesn't want to engage. And she, at the moment, obviously on the question of leadership, is trying to just avoid dealing directly with the question of her own future, of the polls, of the commentary within her party, of the commentary in the sort of more general media landscape. But I think at the same time, you know, these ultimately are questions that are being asked because there is a lot of chatter about her future.
Anna, give the woman credit, for heaven's sake. I mean, it was one of the few questions she answered directly. You said to her, do you have the numbers to survive as leader of the opposition? And she said yes.
Now that was on the third time.
Yeah, it was the third time. But she did say yes, unlike...
Look, yes.
You know, unlike, you know, what seats do you reckon this net zero policy will win the coalition? Now, we didn't get an answer there.
Though she did say she hoped it was all of them. So she certainly had something prepared. But I think the problem that she faces is a credibility problem. And it's one that's related to the fact that it was only, you know, 4 or 5 years ago that she was talking about the importance of reaching net zero by 2050. And you could say David Littleproud was also talking about that as well. They've now got to turn around and tell the electorate not only that, you know, now they've landed on the right policy, that net zero isn't necessary to get emissions down and to reduce power bills. But on top of that, they've got to try and sort of convince their own electorates. Like, this is not just about the parties. And I think this is where the next couple of years are going to be so crucial in what happens next. It's one thing for Susan Lee and David Littleproud to bring the Liberals and the Nationals together to come to an agreement here. It's a very different thing to convince the broader electorate in those city seats, those outer metro seats, and for the Nationals, even some of those seats in the north of New South Wales, for example, on the coast that have dealt with flooding, other natural disasters, where there is a softness in the vote at the moment, and potentially they could face real difficulties in convincing enough voters to side with them at the next election.
Just amazing. Just amazing. I'm very interested in the appearance of Christmas presents as one of the expenses that electors are facing. Now, she said that to you in the interview, and I've heard it a couple of other times today. Apparently this is a reason for us ditching net zero, is that we face expensive Christmas presents. Are you across this argument? Can you help me there?
This just absolutely taps into what the Liberal Party in particular thinks might be the golden magic of this plan, which is if they can tap into that cost of living pressure, and if it's widespread enough, and if people do start to connect the kind of energy policies of the government and the renewables transition policies of the government with the idea that they can't afford the basics, then they think the argument might change. The biggest problem for them, though, is that every kind of credible energy expert that we speak to, economists that we also speak to try and test this idea of renewables, largely the reason that we've got higher power bills, they say that's not the reason. The reason is about the international volatility in prices, aging coal-fired power stations. You know, renewables have some small part to play, but they're not blamed by the experts for what's happening. So this is a huge problem for the Liberals and the Nationals in actually selling where they've landed.
It was another question that she declined to answer when you asked what scientists and economists are actually backing your plan. You didn't get anywhere with that question, did you?
No, I mean, this is what we deal with when we're interviewing politicians. but I do, I think this is one of the issues that they will continue to come up against. And it's one of the things that some of the moderates within the Liberal Party are very aware of, because everyone's getting live feedback from their communities as all this debate is unfolding. And one of the issues is the coherence of the policy and whether it kind of stacks up. And so a lot of people who are very busy and have big pressures in their lives and who are just kind of facing paying the bills and getting on with their jobs and their families might not have as much time to think, you know, does Tony Wood from the Grattan Institute have a position on this? But there are a lot of people that polling has shown over many years are quite engaged on the question of, you know, what happens to the planet and what's the future that we're leaving the next generation, and are fairly knowledgeable about some of these kind of critical issues that Susan Lee is getting pulled up on. So, you know, there are policy holes at the moment that she has to try and deal with.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent with SBS. Anna, why can't we ask about commentary? Why is there a sudden new rule that political leaders won't comment on commentary? Haven't we been commenting on commentary since kind of the beginning of time?
It's a new addition to the pantheon of ways that politicians can avoid tough questions generally about their own popularity. And it's not one that's been confined to just the Liberal Party either. We hear it a lot from the government too. We hear it a lot from all politicians. The Prime Minister was very much leaning into that when he was leading up to the last election and under a lot of pressure about whether or not it was going to be, you know, a minority government. And he reminds journalists in Canberra on a regular basis of how wrong that ended up being and how misjudged he was and underestimated he was. And we heard some of that same kind of language from Susan Lee over the last week as well, using that word underestimated about how she's being treated at the moment. And today she had a pretty tough time too when she was dealing with a radio interview with 2GB, and she was played some clips from members of the public saying they liked Andrew Hastie more than her. So there's been some tough moments for her throughout today in sort of dealing with that question of whether or not she's the right person to lead the Liberal Party. But yes, she leans into that answer of I don't deal with commentary. But sometimes she says it when it's actually facts that are being put to her. So that's also an issue. That's not necessarily a catch-all for just anything that's critical of her, but that's how she's using it at the moment.
Do you think it's the dimple? I mean, Hastie's dimple. Do you think that that gives him kind of extra weight in the community?
Well, I think there are some within the Liberal Party who see him as quite relatable, with a backstory of sort of a strong former military man who wants to come in and get the job done, who is sort of future face of the Liberal Party. You know, there's a big age gap between he and Susan Lee, for example. They know they need to engage with a younger voter base, and perhaps there's a thought that he can bring forward, you know, sort of this kind of fresh appeal of the Liberal Party. But at the same time, the way he's going about it isn't necessarily gathering him a huge support base amongst the moderates or the non-aligned within the party, even though there's this speculation in the papers today that people are switching allegiance to Andrew Hastie. I would be cautious about some of that rhetoric, because I think there's also the possibility that, yes, Andrew Hastie is put forward as an option, but in the end it's actually, you know, Angus Taylor, who we know is very keen on the leadership at some stage, who ends up actually having sort of more strength in numbers behind the scenes to actually make a pitch against Susan Lee at some point.
And they're blokes, and they look like prime ministers, and they wear suits and ties, and they, you know, they fit the bill. Whereas, you know, this is a woman. It's very, very difficult for these people. I do understand them trying the difficulties they're having, getting their heads around the idea.
Yeah, I think that Susan Lee, in dealing with some of the questions that she's dealing with at the moment, around, you know, she's got supporters of hers openly saying, like Maria Kovacic, that she's not being given the clear air to have a clean crack at this job. Frustrated members of her support base within the parliament who, you know, not just disappointed by where things have landed with the net zero debate, but more broadly with how she's being treated, like whether she's being treated with respect by her party. There's a genuine frustration there.
Yes.
And so, you know, when Susan Lee deals with those questions around whether she feels like she has been left hanging out to dry at times by other members of her party, she's always very positive. She always has a smile on her face, and she doesn't want to engage.
She's plucky, and you can see that in her interviews today, plucky. But what passes through their minds when they read the reports in today's press of the latest polling figures, which show One Nation at 18% and the Coalition at 24%? This is diabolical.
Well, what passes through some of their minds, and is sometimes reiterated in conversations when, you know, you do chat to people about these numbers and how worried they are about them, some are panicking and thinking we need to swing harder and more into the right of the Australian political spectrum to make sure that those people don't feel left behind by that us and sort of move to One Nation. But then there's also others, particularly in the moderate wing of the Liberal Party, who are very keen to remind that there's no One Nation representatives in the lower house in the Australian Parliament, and that even if they do have quite strong numbers at the moment, we're nowhere near the next election, and that a lot can happen before then in terms of smoothing out any kind of early swings on support that might be really related to something like campaigning on migration. Because it's quite possible that a lot of people who might be feeling, oh, One Nation might be my party, might not be at all aware of the full nature of the One Nation policy platform. You know, Pauline Hanson is preparing to again introduce an attempt to ban burqas and face coverings in the Australian Parliament. They have some fairly unusual and controversial policies, even in the sort of tax and economics front. They are a party that might at the moment be associated in some people's minds with, you know, an anti-migration platform that resonates, but they have much broader set of platform policies that may well, if there's more coverage of them and more done to show what they stand for, might surprise the people who are, you know, being polled and identifying them as the party that resonates with their politics.
But don't you just leave One Nation to look after One Nation's, you know, tranche of voters and go off and win back the seats that you've lost in the prosperous suburbs of every city in the country? It just, I mean, I'm an amateur. I'm looking at this from the outside. But it does seem strange to leave behind your heartland, your old heartland, and pursue the fringes of One Nation policy. And now we know that immigration is coming up as the next battleground in the coalition.
But interestingly, on both fronts, and on the question of whether or not the Liberal Party is, you know, walking away from areas that it once, you know, held extremely dearly and unquestioningly were going to be handed back to the Liberal Party every election, there is this strong belief, rightly or wrongly, that the cost of power, the cost of energy, can be directly linked with net zero Labor's pitch on renewables, and that over time, as people are dealing with higher costs, that they will make that association and they will start to turn against Labor. That's the belief. And on the migration front as well, there is quite a lot of interest in the community, according to recent polling, in looking at whether or not Australia has to, you know, rein in some way or reduce migration.
Yes.
The sad thing is neither of the parties really has a long-term strategy for how it's going to handle migration. Labor doesn't have one either. It's actually been, you know, behind the times in terms of revealing some of its kind of key figures in sort of annual migration as well. So it's, I think, been described to me by some who watch this area really closely as essentially a policy vacuum. So Labor does have a bit of blame here in terms of not being clear about what its migration policy is either, and trying to rein these figures in. So both parties have a bit to answer for around, you know, being credible on migration, I think.
Sure, but this is a possibility of taking us right back into the heart of race politics as we fight it in Australia, or have fought it since the time of John Howard. And it ain't,
it's tricky territory. It's tricky territory. And you think about the rallies in the streets, and you think about I think the Liberal Party is saying it's going to have principles that it will reveal before Christmas around what it might want to do with migration going forward, similar to the energy principles, I guess. But that doesn't mean that they're going to have any clear guardrails. They're not going to necessarily identify which stream of migration would be focused on. It sounds like international students may be carved out in some way, but, you know, that's also because the uni sector desperately needs that money. You look at backpackers, but that's sort of, you know, Nationals' heartland seats that require
fruit pickers,
workers to go out there. Then what are you left with? The skilled migration categories, and that's including the people who are building the houses, staffing the aged care homes, staffing the childcare centre. And then you're looking at the very small humanitarian intake. So that's unlikely to be, even if that is reduced, a significantly change the number of people coming into Australia. So it's very hard to see how they get there. And don't forget that Peter Dutton, when he went to the last election and said he was going to cut the 25% cut in migration he was talking about, he didn't actually put forward any policy for how he was going to get there. He said he'd do that if elected. So even in the last term of parliament, we didn't have a clear plan from the Liberal Party on migration, even family reunion visas, which are a big issue in multicultural communities,
could be
something that Susan Lee's looking at.
Yeah. Look, in just a minute we have left, can you look to any victory that the opposition has had over the government this year, a win since the elections?
Well, they have worked with the crossbench on a couple of fronts. I think the most recent thing that comes to mind is the freedom of information laws that the government was trying to push through, which certainly raised a lot of controversy around whether or not the government was trying to crack down on transparency. That hasn't gone ahead. And when it comes to the environment protection laws, which we've spoken about in the past, at the moment there's no certainty that that'll get through before Christmas, because both the Greens and the Liberal Party have got concerns about that legislation. So there are areas where the Liberal Party has been able to use its numbers to ensure that things don't progress, and to make trouble for the government, and in some cases block things which they are fundamentally opposed to. But I think what's more important to note is that because there's been so much internal navel-gazing and disagreement within the coalition, quite likely there's a lot of things that the government is doing at the moment that just aren't rising to the surface and being reported as well as they would otherwise be.
Anna, thank you so much for joining us again on Late Night Live. Anna, where can people hear the podcast of your interview with Susan Lee?
Well, they can head to the SBS News website and it's posted there, and look forward to getting some feedback.
And compare and contrast with the interview with Susan Lee on 7:30. Anna, thanks so much for joining us once again on Late Night Live.
A pleasure. Thank you, David.